This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming. So I'm going to start out talking about how UAWD kind of was formed, because they are a big portion of everything that's going on right now, just to kind of put it in a nutshell. So everything started with the corruption in the UAW. I know some of you probably are familiar with the recent, throughout the last, about 5 years, of the different international UAW leaders that were indicted for different corruption stuff within the UAW, most of it is stealing money. So with that being said, throughout the years, there have been other reform groups that were formed within the UAW, such as Drum, Auto Workers Caravan, and New Edition. And they all had great attempts at trying to get... I'm sorry, yes, that's what I meant to say, new direction. Thank you. Some of the members that formed these other groups were also main parts of UAWD. If anybody is in the audience that is a part of UAWD, can you stand up for me, please? Because I'd like to recognize all of you and thank you for all the hard work and dedication that you've done.
I played a very minor role.
I played a very minor role also. So that's why I wanted to make sure that I acknowledge everybody, because it doesn't take just one person. It took a group effort to get this done. And so the first obstacle that UAWD had was, okay, how do we fight this corruption? We need one member, one vote, right? Because our current election, or at that time, our current election system was the delegates to our conventions voted for our elected international executive board. And 90% of the delegates to the convention were trying to beyond that executive board or on staff somewhere or trying to get kickbacks. So they did whatever the administration caucus wanted them to do, whether it was drown people out with noisemakers so you couldn't hear what their points were, what they were trying to let the membership know, or just being rude in general. I've been to four conventions. And the first three were the worst experiences I've ever had. I wanted to walk away crying, because I'm like, this could not be what a union is. This is so divided. This could not be democracy. So that's why UAWD then stepped in and said, hey, we need one member, one vote, so let's get it done. Well, the corruption helped, because then the government stepped in and they were able to give us a referendum vote. And then with that, it was COVID. So what happened during COVID? We were all in the house or in the assembly plants, because we were deemed essential workers. So it was easier to network, and we have social media, so we were able to get out that way. But like I said, it took a lot of hard work and dedication from a lot of people. And the fact that they did all this corruption, it opened up the eyes to our members. So fast forward, we won the referendum vote, one member, one vote, so everybody's able to vote for our International Executive Board. Now the next step was, we got to get out here and get to find people who want to run. And with administration caucus that had been running everything, it was a good old boy system. Nobody, if you weren't in that clique, you weren't in nothing. So it took for people, UAWD, to find people that were ready and willing to stand up and know that you're gonna have a fight. And so we were thankful to find the people that we found, and all of our slate ended up winning. And that is huge. We have never, I'm saying never from the time I've been in the UAW, but I've also heard from people who have been there 30 plus years, they have never seen the transparency that we're seeing now with these contract negotiations for the big three. We have Sean Fain is fabulous at giving, and he's our international president. He's fabulous at giving us feedback and letting us know what's going on every step of the way of these negotiations. Right now, GM hasn't countered back with anything from our demands. Ford countered back with more concessions. Solana, same thing, more concessions. We're demanding for no more concessions, no more tiers, pensions for everybody, retiree health care for everybody, wage increases across the board, job stability. I'm trying to think. Shorter work week. And I don't think that these demands are something that is unattainable. Like, these are demands that we deserve. We work hard for them to make billions of dollars. It's time for us to get our portion.
Great. Thank you. Before we go on to Sean, I want to ask just a couple follow-up things, because obviously the big three auto strike, which is almost certainly going to happen within 2 weeks, is a gigantic deal and very important for everyone in the room, many of whom are union members who are going to be on the picket lines, want to help sort of see this moment and say, as socialists, what is the sort of opportunity presented by a strike of that magnitude, 150,000 auto workers? Sort of as someone who works at one of these plants, who's in UAWD, you know, what's the relationship between what you all have achieved with the reforms already, the elections of reformer candidates to the heights of the union, and then what this contract fight looks like? You know, like, how does it relate to the contract campaign? What does a democratic, militant, rank-and-file unionism contribute to winning those demands? And then I'll let Sean go.
So in past contracts, it was kind of just, they go and do a backdoor, you know, they'll go and just agree to some stuff and push it on us. I feel like now we actually have somebody fighting for us. And it's not just the president goes in and says, hey, this is what we're going to do. No, Sean has made it clear that the president doesn't do all the negotiations. It's not all on the president. We have negotiators, and our negotiators have to be involved in everything, every step of the way. So the transparency is very important, and the fact that they're actually fighting for us, that is very important. Did I answer
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
okay.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Or do you want to just take that one?
I think I can. I'll use both of them. all right. So, hey, everybody, how we doing? My name's Sean Orr. I am a package car driver at UPS here in Chicago, an elected steward with Teamsters Local 705. I was on my local's bargaining committee at UPS, and I'm also a co-chair of TDU. So I guess talking about what has gone on inside my union, the struggle to transform the Teamsters, what we've accomplished, a little bit of what hasn't worked, and then we can kind of take it from there. It's a bit of a tall task because it does go back decades, you know. Same with the UAW, right? Unfortunately, I'm no historian of the Teamsters, but I can speak to my own experience and my involvement in the movement and where the movement's gone in the past few years. I first started at UPS in 2016 up in Wisconsin before moving down here to Chicago. And coming in 2016, that was sort of in the middle of a really reawakening movement at UPS. And I know, you know, this is a conversation about the struggle to transform the Teamsters, but you can't talk about the fight to transform the Teamsters without talking about the shop floor fight at UPS, because one really does inform the other one. You know, the Teamsters are 1.3 million member union. Over 350,000 of those members are at UPS. It's the single largest contract in the union. It's the single largest private sector contract in the entire country. It covers workers in all 50 states outside of here in Illinois, where it's two independent contracts that cover the UPS Teamsters. So it's significant. The movement to reform the Teamsters and to transform it into a fighting class struggle union, you know, that goes all the way back into the fights of the New Deal era with, you know, the Farrell Dobbs and the comrades up in Minneapolis and goes through, you know, the Great Uprising in 34, the general strike into, you know, changing the Teamsters from a craft union of just truck drivers into an industrial union of millions of workers in the logistics and trucking industries. And that covered, you know, countless companies, right? But, you know, as the economy has moved, as, you know, monopolies have formed, and as our industry has changed over the decades, a lot of those historic industries around freight, around interstate trucking, a lot of that has really fallen. But the Teamsters, instead of falling, have kind of leveled out because UPS grew, and UPS became a dominant part of our union, really in like the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, here in Chicago, Local 705, when the 1997 strike happened, the majority of 705 members were still in freight. Now, the vast majority of 705 members are all at UPS. So our industry's really changed. And because of that, UPS plays a central role. The shop floor struggle at UPS plays a central defining role in our union. And we've seen that kind of play out with different moments feeding into each other, usually around these contract fights, right? So in 2013, there was a big contract struggle at UPS. Hoffa Jr., he ran the union. He had run it since 1998, giving concession after concession to UPS and to all other corporations that we cover. TDU and a small group of rank-and-file militants at UPS started to build a Vote No movement there in the 2013 against Hoffa's contract offer. And while the offer passed, didn't pass by that much. And it was a big fight in the union, something that was a little unexpected, right? Now, that led to, a few years later, the 2016 international election in our union, right? So you see UPS fight out on the shop floor leading into this bigger political fight inside of our union and the direction of our union. We had running against Hoffa, Fred Zuckerman, who was a candidate backed by TDU and by the reform movement. That reform movement only had single-digit percentage of the delegates at our international convention the year prior, yet we came within 6,000 votes of taking the entire union over in 2016. That caught everybody by surprise. That even caught us in the reform movement by surprise. And let us know that what was going on at UPS was also going on at a lot of these other companies, where Teamsters, rank-and-file workers, really wanted to see change in their union. They wanted a union leadership that responded to their demands, to their desire for militancy, to their desire to have a dignified job. We saw that play out again with 2018, the UPS contract, right? Hoffa knew that, you know, things were a little different in the union. So, you know, he appointed this guy, Sean O'Brien, to run negotiations at UPS. He brought on Fred Zuckerman and a few other Teamster officials who were in the reform slate from the couple years prior. And they started talking about doing things a little differently, started talking about engaging with the membership, started talking about bringing in more of these reform-minded Teamster officials. He was quickly pushed out as the lead negotiator. This other guy, Dennis Taylor, took over things. And Dennis Taylor and Hoffa, they put forward a contract that offered a ton of concessions to UPS, including a proposal that came from them of creating a two-tiered driver classification at UPS. That was something that the union thought was a good idea. And they pitched it as, you know, look, we want to give UPS the flexibility to have you work in the warehouse a little bit and then go out and make deliveries and make less money than other drivers because we want, you know, we want to relieve overtime and we want to do all this other stuff. They tried to spin it like that and it was all horseshit. And we knew that. You know, they put it forward, they put this thing to a vote, and it got voted down. You know, that vote no movement from 2013 kept building and building and building, and we voted that contract down in 2018. Yet, because of a constitutional loophole, it got forced down on us anyways. That, again, built into this broader catalyst for change in the entire union. And we saw that take place in 2021 when the O'Brien-Zuckerman slate, the Teamsters United slate, took the union over on a 2-1 basis. We swept it clean, but we won the vote on a 2-1 basis. And that was a huge signal that, you know, regardless of any of the other distinctions in what union leadership is, and there's a lot and we can get into them, the defining question in that election was, do you believe that your job as a leader of the union is to collaborate with the employers or fight the employers? That was the distinction, and it was a really easy one. And both sides embraced their side. The Hoffa slate, they had flyers that they handed out saying that they wanted to strengthen collaboration with the employers. They owned it. And that makes it really easy for us, you know? They owned the collaboration that they sought. And O'Brien and Zuckerman and the rest of the slate, they said, no, our job is to fight the employers and to be responsive to the demands of the rank and file. That's why they won in the landslide. Now, throughout all of that, TDU has sort of served as an organizing hub, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, an organizing hub for any rank-and-file Teamsters that wanted to get involved in changing their union, making it more militant, more democratic. And we did that in 2021 with some constitutional changes, getting rid of that two-thirds rule that allowed that previous contract to be forced on us. We got day one strike benefits. We got a couple other little tweaks. The big thing was we got new leadership elected in the IBT, and you know, in that as a coalition partner and a minority partner at that. TDU has never been a majority organization inside the Teamsters, and there's a lot of reasons for that, and a lot of them go back decades. But there were plenty of good fighters, you know, class fighters, people on the shop floor, rank and file leaders, stewards, militants who fight the company, who want to fight the company, but they didn't join TDU for a number of different reasons. Some of them were local politics. TDU was taught to a lot of people as meaning to destroy unions. There was a lot of, you know, essentially like a form of McCarthyism inside the Teamsters towards TDU. We were called outside agitators, that we didn't belong in the union, that we weren't a part of the union, we were out to destroy the Teamsters. And that is a big hurdle, and that was a big hurdle to get over. When we'd run our own candidates, we'd get a single-digit amount of votes internationally. We entered this coalition with the hope that we would be able to come out the other side as a national network that can then further deepen the change in our union. And that's what did come out the other side of this. That sort of McCarthyite smear of TDU bashing, that went the other way. When we were on the front line of this international election that swept our union, that changed the leadership over by the margin that it did, and now TDU finds itself as a home for rank and file militants, no matter where they are, in places where TDU couldn't even get one member because if they showed up to a union meeting as an open TDU member, they'd be chased out of there. Now we have dozens of members who are organizing, who are stewards, who are have networked up and are building the fight at UPS. Now, another big change that we got was the bringing the contract campaign model to the Teamsters. The Teamsters are a really old school union. They still are a very, very old school union. All of the changes that happened in our labor movement over the past 20 years, they all pass them by. They never heard of social justice unionism, social movement unionism. They had never heard of a contract campaign. They barely even heard of the corporate campaign stuff. You know, all of that stuff just went way over their head. They're this little island out there just doing their own thing. And that's a big pivot to try to make. But we did get a successful contract campaign at UPS. We built a credible strike threat there. And in doing so, we won a pretty significant tentative agreement. We moved the ball forward. We've got a lot more ground to make. But it's something that I think we're damn proud of. And we've got a lot of work left to build on.
Good afternoon. My name is Quentin Washington. I am a elementary school music teacher. And I've been at this now, this is school year 22 with Chicago Public Schools. And it's been a very interesting journey, to say the least. My experience with the Teachers Union, Chicago Teachers Union specifically, started around 2009, actually. So I was very familiar with the union. My mother's a teacher, was a retired librarian. My aunts and uncles, her siblings, are also educators. And so I come from a long line of Chicago public school people. So I understood the union, and I understood the necessity of having a union and all of that. However, I did not get fully involved in the union until about 2009. And it was an interesting journey to watch where we have been as a city and how our union has impacted the city over the last decade and a half, looking at what the city had done, you know, to us, so to speak. So for those of you all that may not be familiar with Chicago politics as it pertains to Chicago Teachers Union, in 1995, Mayor Daley had gone to the state and requested that he gets to run the school district. So that was the School Reform Act of 1995. And I believe at that time, the leadership downstate was Republican. And so they said, okay. And so I think I was a senior in high school when this happened, maybe a junior, I don't remember. But the point is it happened. And as a result, we lost our bargaining rights as a union. So that's pretty significant, right? You know, your bargaining contracts that you can basically only talk about, you know, how much money they're going to pay you, maybe what your benefits are going to be, when there's so many other things that are way more or just as important or way more important just to making your job functional for your students. Because as an educator, it's not just about getting what we need as the teacher in the classroom, but how is it that the resources that we're getting, how are those resources impacting our students? How is it impacting our school communities? How are the families that we are servicing impacted by the things that we're dealing with or the things that we request? And so, you know, there's this whole back and forth down through the years. You know, Mayor Daley was Mayor Daley. And then comes, you know, every contract round, you know, there's this concession and that concession. And specifically, if my memory serves me correctly, there was a situation around 2004 where they were talking about closing schools. So when I started with CPS in 2002, I had just graduated from grad school. I went to Langston University for my undergrad in Langston, Oklahoma. So it's a historically black college in the state of Oklahoma. And when I finished at Langston, I went to Oklahoma City University to get my master's degree in education. And so when I finished that, I came back here, started working in CPS. And I started out as a day-to-day sub. Started out as a day-to-day substitute, always working as a music teacher. So I'm 23 years old at the time, and I go into the school community, I get hired, and one of the first things that I saw was I saw this Renaissance 2010 thing. And I'm like, what's that? And they were, you know, this great plan to put all these charter schools into our school district and then there was this whole turnaround thing that was happening, which was in 2004. They were turning around schools. So for those of y'all that may not know what that means they go into your school community, they decide that your school is failing, even though they've not resourced it, even though they've not given the school the bare necessities to really thrive. Then they come in and decide this is a failing community school. We're gonna close it down. Everyone in here is fired. You need to reapply for your job. We're going to bring in all these resources and help you be a better school. When you could have just resourced the school in the first place, and it would have been an issue, right? But again, I digress. This is, in my opinion, this is how, you know, you get corporate dollars and corporate interest into the public school setting. And this stuff was happening primarily in black and brown communities. It was happening around my neighborhood. I live in West Pullman. Out on 119th Street, near 119th. And even today, I drive past school buildings that were closed in 2013, after our 2012 strike. And so it's always been this back and forth, right, between the politics of Chicago and the Chicago Teachers Union. And then there came a point where the Chicago Teachers Union really had to kind of get to a place where, like, okay, now how long are we going to keep on putting up with this? Now, which brings us to the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, or CORE. So CORE was founded in 2008 by Jackson Potter. I believe Jesse Sharkey was there. These two individuals are sitting in the room, by the way. Also, Karen Lewis, and there's a great group of people. Stacey Davis Gates was there, I believe, and Jen Johnson was there. And you had these educators from various parts of the city that came together to say, hey, what are we going to do about what's going on? And I'm paraphrasing, by the way, because I wasn't there. But but in this coming together and realizing something's going to have to give if we're going to really make some changes and transform this city and these schools into the schools that our children deserve and that their families deserve. And so from there, CORE was founded, and CORE ran on a platform of change and a platform of social justice unionism, which was kind of new to CTU to a certain extent, to the extent that it was happening. And so recognizing that we didn't have bargaining rights or very limited bargaining rights, and also recognizing that we were dealing with an ever-increasing hostile relationship with the fifth floor of the city hall, CORE's leadership greatly started impacting what was happening, not just in CTU and not just in our schools, but really in our city, because CORE started doing things that, you know, that was just transformational. So, interesting story. 2012 strike. This is my first strike. Now, when they had the strike in 1987, I was in fourth grade. So, you know, I was in fourth grade. We was out of school for 19 days. I'm like, well, we chilled, you know, at the house. My grandmother made us read and, you know, have some form of school. But we was at the house. That was the longest school year. I thought it was going to never be over when we finally made up all the strike days. So 2012 comes, and I'm sitting there thinking, okay, well, we're on strike, and so we're going to be out for a few days. I went to Lowe's. Let me tell y'all what I did. I had gone to Lowe's after church that Sunday. I said, I'm going to get a gallon of some paint. I'm going to paint this bedroom while we off. And I'm going to kind of chill and just kind of decompress while we're doing this. Clearly clueless, right? And so I've had all these plans. I had a whole backyard party that Sunday night as we were trying to decide for sure. We didn't know whether or not we were going to actually be out. And so we kind of watching the news and we're in the backyard. I got the tiki torches going. My friends are there. We got the barbecue. We have adult beverages and we are in a chill space. And then they say, okay, we're officially going on strike. I'm like, okay, we're on strike. Then I get a text message. Meet at the school at 7 a.m. I said, wait, what? I said, is that what's happening? So get to the school. And the next thing I know, we're out in the streets. And at the time, I was at Allgale Elementary School on 71st and Loomis. And we're standing on the corner of 71st and Loomis. Bond Elementary is the next closest school. They're down on 71st and Racine. And we're all, like, we're doing our thing on the corner of Loomis. They're doing their thing down on Racine. Then we got the look, our students show up with their buckets, and they out there beating and banging with us, and we're marching up and down 71st. The next thing I know, it's this whole situation happening. And then, after that happens, it's like, okay, go downtown. We're going to meet downtown at this. I said, wait, we got to go downtown, too? Okay. Get downtown. And, man, we get down there in the streets, and I think we was on Clark Street. We was out in front of the Board of Education. And literally, it's just this sea of red is all I could see. And I'm like, wow. So in this moment, it was like, dang, so this is what teachers unions do. We get out here and run amok, and we act a fool for change, and we get the things that we want. And it was in that moment that it really clicked and resonated for me that what we were doing was so much bigger than us. And what made that significant to me was when I realized that some of my students had made the trek downtown to be with us and their parents. And then every morning they were bringing things for us to have to snack on and drinks. And a couple of the days when it started to get a little cool, they were bringing coffee and hot chocolate and supporting us. And it started making me realize just what we were doing and how significant it was to the young people that were watching us and to the school communities that were experiencing this with us. And so, you know, 2012 happened. We went on strike. We did get some of the things that we wanted. You know, of course, when you're bargaining, you don't get everything you want. But, you know, we had a good, what I considered a successful strike. And then, you know, as Stacey liked to say, you know, when you're in the fight with the boss, the boss gets to swing. You know, you throw punches and they throw punches too. So then, of course, they closed 55 schools in mostly black and brown communities. My school was one of them. So I had to find another job, which by God's grace, I did find another school to go to. But it's just a constant back and forth, right? So you say, well, how do you continue to grow this union power? I mean, that was a hit. That was a blow to us. But we organized. We continued to organize ourselves. And we continued to get into our school communities and build coalition with the school communities, with our parents and with our students even, so that they understood what it was that we were fighting for. We weren't just fighting for a nice check. I mean, you know, I like to be able to pay my bills because I like to eat. And I like to be able to go into a school community that has a well-resourced building, that has students that feel safe, students that feel like they're being educated and feel like they have teachers and around them that care and have the resources around them to make them successful. So fast forward, we had 2012, then we had 2019. And 2019 was a lot, followed by COVID. So COVID changed the whole game. And so that was like the craziest experience that probably any of us in this room have ever had, right? As far as an international health crisis. And in this moment, we are working from home, and then they decide to make us go back to school, and then they didn't tell us how we were going to get back into the school. And so here we are fighting again. And in this moment, I'm damn mad. Can I just be, if I can be really transparent, that I got pissed. You know, the other strikes, I was mad too, but COVID was a whole nother thing because it's like, now you really messing with my life, not just my livelihood, but now you're not even thinking about my life and how what you're asking me to do is going to impact my life, my students' lives, and we're seeing all the devastation all around us. And so we did what we do, and we drew a line in the sand, and we fought back. But that fight was not without consequences, right? People assume that you fight, you know, you may get a scratch here or there, and then, you know, you go on. But these types of fights, because they have been political in nature, it caused us to even start thinking about politically what our political game structure was. And so you look at Chicago Teachers Union and the things that we've invested in, we started realizing that we need to get some allies. You know, the things that we needed to do, we couldn't do it on our own. We need to have allies in the spaces and in the rooms that we're making these decisions. And so we started building those coalitions, and we started finding people whose values aligned with ours so that we can be successful, right? And so that brings us to, through, you know, 2020 and COVID and, well, 2021, getting back into school, having a mayor that was fighting us tooth and nail, a mayor that locked us out of our classrooms for, you know, weeks. I think I was locked out for 20 days out of my virtual classroom. And it was worth it to me because my life is invaluable to me. I can't put a price tag on my head. And I can't put a price tag on the heads of the people around me whose lives will be impacted if I get sick. And so we went through that fight, but I knew then beyond a shadow of a doubt, this lady here on this fifth floor has got to go. So, you know, and I, you know, that was a general consensus with several. And so, I mean, I'm just saying. And so here we are now in 2023, and CTU, through the organizing that we've done, through the coalition building that we've done, the grassroots efforts and the grassroots organizing within communities and that we've done, we've been fortunate enough to see one of our own become the mayor of this great city of Chicago. But again, yeah, it's, you know, some days it's like, wow, that happened. But that happened because there was a lot of sacrifice made. There were a lot of people that really sacrificed, sacrifice of time, sacrifice of resources, and recognizing that the goal is, if we want to see a strong school community built, if we want to see schools that are well-resourced, we need to get somebody in that office that knows what that is like, right? We need to get somebody downtown that recognizes that we need those types of things and that would be sensitive to the plight of school children. We need somebody that cares about people. Because at the end of the day, as an educator, if you don't care about people, you're probably in the wrong profession. Maybe you need to go be a botanist or whatever. Is that what they call people? But dealing with people is not your thing. And so we've built this coalition, and this coalition is still building even as we speak. Because, yeah, we have Mayor Johnson at on the fifth floor, and we have this strong unionism that we do together, and we still have schools that we have to be concerned about when it's 100 degrees outside, right? Like, how are we going to resource that stuff? The difference is now we have a space where people know that the real boss is paying attention, so they become a lot more pleasant in certain conversations, right? And that's where the kind of the space that we're in right now. But ultimately, as I close this little section, I will just say that it's important to recognize what your goals are and then make a strategic plan to get there. What does that look like? And then build the coalition to make it happen. CTU is a big ship to try to steer. And so coalition building just amongst our membership in and of itself is not something that just happens with flipping on a light switch and saying, hey, this is what's happening. Because there are going to be a whole lot of questions. But one of the things I love about CTU and what we do, it's one of the most democratic spaces I've ever been in. You know, whether you're the president, whether you're the vice president, whether you're a rank and file member, your voice is going to be heard. And even if you don't agree, you know, I've had some of the most liveliest debates I've ever encountered in CTU. You know, you could be, as Jesse likes to say, you could be hard on ideas and easy on people, you know, because that is what makes us all great. To be able to think those things through, that's what building unionism is all about. And so I'm going to stop there.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.